Europeans digest the future of trade now that the German leader is back home from the U.S. and the U.S. Treasury Secretary is back from Germany. From Marketplace in New York, I'm David Brancaccio. Senior officials from the Group of 20 big economies met in Germany this weekend, where U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin refused to agree to a communique to, quote, resist all forms of protectionism, meaning some forms are now okay. Mnuchin's German counterpart, Wolfgang Schäuble, sounded frustrated, saying the G20 has, quote, reached an impasse. And Europe was also parsing the awkward meeting in Washington on Friday between German Chancellor Angela Merkel and President Donald Trump, watching from Berlin as the U.S. laid down the line, as Stefan Richter, editor-in-chief of TheGlobalist.com.
The issue is they reject any kind of multilateralism, and instead they feel that if they just do bilateral deals, they can always pull the other side over the table in some kind of strong-arming contest. And that's not how global trade has been organized, and that's not how it's going to work in the future, because it's taking any kind of complexity that is inherent to the global economic system out of it and just makes it not just America great, but America unquestionably number one in every deal. And the Europeans don't understand that to be the art of the deal that works. That may have been Mr. Trump's past as a real estate guy, but it won't work for the President of the United States.
All right. Also on this issue of trade, the big G20 meeting was happening in Germany, and U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin was there. And that process also pointed in a similar direction. The U.S. seems to be backing off of the last 30 years of increasing globalization.
Yes, very much so. It was the key pushing force, and now it's the one that stays outside. We don't live in a G20, but in a G19 world. And Mr. Mnuchin basically played a Russian-style refusenik.
Stefan Richter, editor-in-chief of The Globalist, speaking from Berlin. Stefan, thank you.
All the best, David.
Let's check the markets now. The FTSE index in London is down 0.2%. The Dow future is down 19 points, less than 0.1%. Market participants have been especially watching crude oil last couple days. It's down 1.4% to $48 a barrel in New York now. It was 30 years ago this week that the Food and Drug Administration approved the first treatment for HIV/AIDS. At a time when the number of AIDS-related deaths was skyrocketing, AZT was rushed through the approval process. In one clinical trial, it was halted early, the trial, because patients taking a placebo were doing so badly. But some of the early advocates of AZT's rapid approval ended up lamenting that process. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has more.
In 1987, AIDS activists in the U.S. were clamoring to get the FDA to quickly approve AZT, even though it had a lot of side effects. Jonathan Engel, a medical historian at the City University of New York, says people wanted anything to prolong life.
They went, "This is crazy. You're sitting here telling us that some of these molecules and drugs might be dangerous to our health. We're dying. We are 100% dying."
Because AZT was fast-tracked, the right dosage wasn't well-established. It was super pricey, with treatments costing as much as $10,000 per year. Plus, it turned out not to be very effective when used in isolation. David France is the author of a book about the AIDS crisis called How to Survive a Plague. He says some AIDS activists who initially favored fast-tracking drugs eventually changed their minds.
AIDS activists stood in the way of the pharmaceutical companies who wanted to release them right away to the patient population and insisted upon a large and reliable trials.
He says ultimately they wanted better information on dosing, efficacy, and long-term effects. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
One of the most influential financial institutions in the world wants to do something it's never done. Lend you a little money to maybe spruce up your kitchen? Goldman Sachs has a new offering called Marcus, an online platform to make small loans. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports on the giant acting small.
This is the slice of Goldman very few people have ever seen, home to CEO Lloyd Blankfein and the firm's top leadership, as well as a gallery of oil paintings of their predecessors.
We are on the 41st floor, which is the executive office. We are standing in front of the portrait of Marcus Goldman, founder of the firm.
and the namesake of its digital startup. The idea is to build an online lender, a new tech company inside an old bank. There's a striking contrast between the sturdy formality of the executive suite and the much lower floor where the Marcus team works. Goldman head of digital finance Harit Talwar takes us on a tour.
And as you can see on this floor, we are very excited because it is quite different from a normal floor in the building.
That's not to say it's some ratty startup nest with bros waging Nerf gun battles. It's still Goldman, so the desks are sleek and the windows offer commanding views of New York's skyline. But the staff does not shop at the investment banking clothing store.
Some are wearing jeans and some are wearing slacks. I don't think we have people in suits.
Their resumes are unusual for Goldman, too. Most have financial backgrounds, but a third come from Google, Facebook, and other places far from banking. That's important at a time when investment banks worry about losing top talent to flashy technology companies. Marcus is a test of whether a legacy bank can compete with startups in building the next generation of finance. Morningstar bank analyst Jim Sinegal says it's a tough challenge that everyone in the business is watching.
It's one of the highest profile experiments we've seen in the banking industry. Most of the other banks have not made moves on this scale.
It's a bold bet, and losing could mean getting left behind by younger competitors in a space that could transform the very core of banking.
We have the duality of being new with a 147-year history. This is a 147-year-old startup.
Talwar and his team know they're under pressure to perform from the firm's leaders, investors, and from old Marcus Goldman, watching from upstairs. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
And spring began 29 minutes and 50 seconds ago. Northern Hemisphere, enjoy. I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.